point, Jill Decker's on her way.
Welcome to the Dawn of Shades on this very warm August 14th, 2007. I am your host, Ia Scott, and tonight is a very special night. It's a red letter day. My daughter is actually listening in. I'm going to embarrass her a little bit with a belated birthday wish. She turned a year older yesterday, and since she's a young lady, I must be polite and not state the number. So, once again, happy birthday, Mary Martha. Now, it's been a scorching hot week for most of the Northern Hemisphere, with heat advisories and warnings affecting many locations every day. I don't know if it's global warming or just a really hot summer, but these dog days of summer are certainly dragging on. With schools starting back up, I'm sure I'm not alone in looking forward to the cooler days of fall. Now, while on the subject of schools, a common theme in many ideologies lately has been that our time here on this planet, in this body, is a time not unlike school, where we're here to learn lessons that will affect our very soul. Sometimes we look enviously at someone and think, oh, wow, they have an easy life. Few problems, few woes, lots of joy. How do they get so lucky? And then we look at our own lives with dissatisfaction and finding faults with everything about it. Or maybe we've got this all wrong. The person with few obstacles to navigate through has few learning opportunities. Their soul isn't making much progress and seems to be just wasting time, waiting for the next phase. The grief and sorrow and trouble and agony that we tackle every day gives us immeasurable learning opportunities for our souls to learn and grow, and we need to embrace these opportunities. I hope with each week's Dawn of Shades that I bring you something to help you learn and grow to speed your journey towards spiritual enlightenment. Tonight's show is on a topic long taboo, one that I can remember was not even whispered behind closed doors because it was so awful. That refusal to acknowledge it may have given it more power than it should have ever had. And perhaps the best way to get rid of any monster is by confronting it in the light, examining it from each angle and taking away the power that it possesses. I hope so. Tonight's guest has done a lot towards doing just that. And without too much more mystery, I'm going to let you know, tonight's topic is suicide. The guest is Pamela Heath, one of the co-authors of Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife. I want everybody to know, this is one of those books that just left me saying, wow, and it got a fast skimming over. I definitely intend to give it a much more complete reading, because it has some fantastic messages that affect us all, even if we are neither suicidal nor left behind by someone who is. Now, Pamela, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you for having me on tonight.
Oh, I'm glad to have you on. Could you give a brief introduction to the audience about yourself, sort of let them know who you are and maybe even why you wrote this book?
Well, I'm both a physician and a parapsychologist. I have 2 doctorate degrees, and the book actually kind of grew out of my experiences with John Climo, my co-author, who is the head of my dissertation program. And he talked about an experience he'd had when he was once asked to gather together information said to come from the afterlife about what it's like for suicides over there. And the reason being that there was a woman who was suicidal, and you know, she sort of wanted to know what she was getting into, informed consent. And the thought was that if she really knew what she was getting into, she probably wouldn't do it. And, you know, he shared with me some of these messages. I think he had about 20 pages worth. And I just thought, what a wonderful thing that this could really help people understand what they're getting into and perhaps make better decisions, better choices.
Uh-huh. And so why this particular time? I mean, was it just because you had the information and got it done now, or did you feel that the timing was just right for the book?
A combination of things. You know, part of it was I felt John should have written the book 10 years ago, and he didn't do it, you know. And I kept going, John, you got to write this book. John, you got to write this book. And he didn't want to do it. It really was a lot of work to do. We pulled information from I probably went through about 400 or 500 channeled books and other pieces of material to find what was we ended up using in the book. And in fact, about a fourth of those are actually quoted that had material that was pertinent to suicides. And, you know, this book just takes the position that if there's an afterlife, and those who are in it can communicate back to the living, you know, what would they tell us about their experiences? And it's just fascinating stuff, and especially with society right now fighting over issues such as euthanasia, you know, assisted suicide.
Right.
And the whole issue of the suicide bombers. I think that would be probably the biggest new slant I brought to the topic, is John originally just looked at traditional suicides, and I was like, let's look at every type of suicide, and that way we can sort of see if there are differences, and if so, you know, kind of get a sense of what those differences mean.
Yeah, you know, in the book you did quote some amazing statistics, I mean, things like 1 out of 9 suicides is successful, that it's a 10th leading cause of death, and that for physicians under age 40, it is the leading cause of death. What do these sort of statistics really mean? You know, do we have an increasing rate of suicide, or is it an...
gradually coming out of the area of taboo, people are starting to be willing to admit that that's what happened. And so you are seeing an increase in reporting. But I also think you're seeing an increase in true incidents. And it's become an epidemic in countries around the world, not just the United States. I mean, every country we look at, China and Europe, you know, France is having a huge problem. Britain is having a huge problem. This is a worldwide epidemic right now. And part of it, I think, is also a symptom of sort of a spiritual disenfranchisement that a lot of people are feeling.
That's true. You know, another facet of suicide that I had never realized existed is that it can be contagious. That, an example, you know, a prominent or admired figure commits suicide, the followers or fans may follow suit. That, and this phenomenon in ancient times may have actually led to a lot of the traditional sanctions forbidding suicide and spreading through a community. Do you think that that's still a real potential threat in today's society?
No, absolutely. I mean, that was a real concern when Kurt Cobain committed suicide. And you see it even on a microscopic level in terms of high school. If one high school kid commits suicide, it's very common. You'll see a lot of kids who knew him in class, him or her, commit suicide too. And it's something that a lot of schools are extremely aware of and try to, you know, prevent. But it's a real hazard.
You know, and then, too, we've had, you know, like the high school and the college even shootings where someone goes in and kills other people and kills themselves. You know, that's still a suicide.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's frightening for a lot of kids.
Pardon? Sorry, that just falls into the last category of suicide we looked at, which is suicide mass murder.
And you talked about a number of cases in your book, too.
Yeah, not as many as we would have liked. You know, the Columbine killers, for example, nobody channeled them. They didn't come through at all. And I was kind of hoping we could get something about that. But it's a growing problem. And, you know, we see it probably most visibly as suicide bombers and suicide bomb attacks. But it seems like every week you can turn on the TV and hear about someone else who has decided to go into a workplace and start shooting.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was 2 cases just this last week that I remember reading, you know, the headlines about, you know, and that is kind of frightening to think about, that, you know, nobody's really safe anywhere if someone does decide to choose that sort of exit.
It's similar to traditional suicide, I think, than I would have thought, in terms of what triggers it and what's going on, sort of the underlying problem. And to me, that was one of the surprises of the book, is I sort of felt like each of these three areas would be quite different. And they really, the only one that was really different is the assisted suicide. That appears to be quite a different kettle of fish. If you're terminal, you're at the end of your life, that's a very different situation than if you're taking others out with you or if you're killing a healthy body.
Yeah, and that was something that I definitely, got the impression from, that each suicide was being judged essentially by the intent, and the circumstances around it, that it was a very individualized sort of judgmental thing going on, that it wasn't, you committed suicide, you're going to hell.
Well, the other thing is that we judge ourselves, and that's really the tricky thing. You know, suicides in the afterlife go through all the same phases and stages as people who die by other causes. But the difference is certain areas appear to be more difficult for them. The transition can be more difficult. They can have more trouble seeing spirit helpers. And, of course, when you get to the life review and self-judgment, it is a self-judgment. Other people aren't sitting, you know, telling you how awful you are. You're judging yourself. But I think we all know from our own personal lives that when you screw up and you hurt other people around you, it's very hard to forgive yourself. And in fact, I think some of these people have a much harder time forgiving themselves, and they're much harsher in self-judgment than others would be who were looking at their situation.
Yeah, before we go too much further, one thing I would like for you to explain to myself and the audience is exactly how does this channeling work? Because sometimes people have very strange conceptions of how a medium could be channeling a spiritual entity.
Okay. Basically, what channeling is when you have sort of a telepathic communication between a discarnate, in this case, a discarnate entity, and we were looking only at people who are said to be human spirit guides and not other folks. And can telepathically communicate messages back to the living about these experiences. But I'd like to say not all of the material in this book was channeled, because you do have to worry about bias, distortion, and inaccuracies that can creep into channeled material. So what we did is we tried to gather other sources of information, whether it be normal people's dream experiences, whether it be hypnotic regression, you know, to past lives or periods between lives. We also looked at the psychomantium experiences. A lot of these.
Why don't you explain that term as well, the psychomantian experiences?
It's something that was sort of created by Raymond Moody, involving if you have a mirror set up and you have a chair sitting in front of it, and you sit down in front of the mirror. Have a dim room lit by maybe like a 15-watt light bulb, and you just sort of stare into the mirror, and you put yourself into a altered state of consciousness that will sometimes let you perhaps be more psychic, or at least be more in touch with material from your unconscious. So it can be used by psychiatrists and psychologists, you know, just to bring up unconscious stuff, but it can also sometimes allow you to sort of be more aware of the spirit realm. And some people had experiences where deceased loved ones came back and they saw them sort of in the mirror and had discussions with them.
Okay. Well, I hope that clears things up for a little bit for the audience as far as exactly what we're talking about when we do talk about the channeling and whatnot.
Oh, and since you are having PMH Atwater coming, we also looked at near-death experiences.
Yes, there was, and she was quoted several times in the book as well. There was lots of stuff, about that.
And data, too. So.
Yeah, I mean, the book actually covered an immense amount of material. You know, it's not that big of a book, really, but it really goes over a lot. Now, you know, speaking of PMH Atwater and the near-death experiences, you wrote that failed suicide attempts often did result in near-death experiences. Mm-hmm. At one point, you said they were more likely to be very positive than hellish, to actually become a suicide inhibitor.
They run the same gamut as normal near-death experiences.
That's what I read later. I found that a little confusing.
Yeah, from all causes of death, you can have near-death experiences that range from negative, you know, hellish experiences to very positive angelic experiences. And it seems like this appeared to also be true for suicides. And the problem that some suicides could get into is they would see what a wonderful afterlife experience, you know, it was, and they decided life was, you know, their version of hell. You know, why stay there any longer? And they would try to commit suicide again and again. So they wouldn't necessarily get the lesson that, you know, you need to complete your tasks, or you're just going to have to do it over again, and it's going to be that much harder.
Well, I found it interesting, too, that the common theme in the channel's messages was pretty much the same, that our lives here, no matter what sort of misery we may be forced to tackle, we're part of a learning process, and that by dropping out of, you know, the soul school, you might, mm-hmm. and opting for suicide, mm-hmm. you really didn't escape anything.
Mm-hmm.
That you just went, you know, it set you back.
Absolutely. That's a huge message in the book. And in fact, there's quite a lot of material on the regret that suicides report back, including, you know, wasted potential, karmic backsliding, and of course, obvious things, you know, how their death affected others.
Yeah, you know, deaths do, especially suicide, I mean, it is, because you do look what an utter waste it was.
There also seems to be some tendency, if you've committed suicide in a previous life, to be more apt to do it in a future one. And so another thing we sort of saw is some of them sort of dreaded and were afraid of reincarnating again, because they knew that their lessons were going to be just that much harder.
Uh-huh.
And they really weren't looking forward to it.
Well, I don't think any of us look forward to a painful lesson when we know that that's what we're going to get.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the kid, you know, that knows mom has found out that you got in a fight. Walk home is going to be a long walk.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it's the same distance as always, it, you know, it does seem much more difficult. Because you know what you're facing. You know, also in the book, you frequently quoted Swedenborg's writings.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that they often agreed with the messages channeled by the mediums from the spirits of those who had committed suicide?
There's a fair bit of common ground. One of the things that was sort of nice about Swedenborg is it's such a different culture and era, and we were trying to really get the broadest range of messages we could find. So by having things, I mean, if you want to get technical about it, we even go back to Islamic Book of the Dead. We say something about that, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and those kind of things. But really, Swedenborg is probably the earliest major source, you know, in the 1700s. And then we've got to modern-day mediums like George Anderson and John Edwards and James von Prague. So we wanted to sort of show that there wasn't necessarily a huge amount of difference. Even though these were very different cultures and very different times, these people are supposedly reporting back very similar experiences, which suggests, you know, on the common ground that there's something to this. It's not just what somebody in Japan says, or somebody in the U.S. says, or somebody modern day says.
And then maybe it's just not somebody's wishful thinking?
Yeah. Now, there are some variations, and we try to point out when someone says something that's not said by anything else, you know, anyone else, but
right.
there's
right.
an amazing amount of common ground, and that's what we really looked for, is where was everything the same or very similar things. And, like, after we finished the book, you know, I was kind of sorry, I picked up a book by a medium in the Netherlands and was reading, it was an entire channeled book just about one suicide's afterlife experiences, and it was like, I could just, like, check mark things off. It's like, yep, that's what others said. Yep, that's what others said. And it really, for me, gave me a lot of confidence, sort of, in the fact that we weren't coming out of the blue with this stuff. This is this is very consistent information that we're getting from, you know, the other side, if you want to believe
and that. And the time period that you had these channeled messages from, dated from the 1800s on to, you know, here and now, and yet, you know, it was usually a pretty common thread. I mean, it might be phrased differently.
Yeah, I think where you saw the most difference was in reincarnation. A lot of the early mediums just could not wrap their head around the idea of reincarnation.
And yeah, that's something else that a lot of people question, because the medium's perceptions and values and belief system does affect how they relay the message, I would think.
Absolutely, and we do talk about that in the book. If you read some of the introductory chapters, for example, we try and talk about all of this material, and as we present it, we try and point out where some of these pitfalls, you know, may be rearing their heads. And if the material was ever too off the wall, you know, where it was just obvious that it was inaccurate, I did not include it. For example, we had one guy who claimed to be channeling Shakespeare and was talking about all the women actresses. You know, anyone who knows history knows that the men played those parts, you know. It was just so historically inaccurate that I just sort of tossed the book, and I was like, look, you know, clearly this is not Shakespeare's job. You know, and so there were cases like that where it was just obvious that the material was, shall we say, fabricated or wishful thinking, or, you know, coming from someone's unconscious and not truly.
Didn't you also mention, too, that there was, I think it was in your book, maybe it was something else I read, but I thought it was in your book, that sometimes there are tricksters in spiritual realms.
Yeah, we do talk about that. There are people, well, they like attention. I mean, just like human beings, sometimes it's, oh, you want to talk to this? Well, I'll pretend this is what I am, and, you know, and that way you'll listen to me, attention to me, and they like that.
Well, you know, many cultures have traditions about spiritual tricksters as well. But whenever possible, I got the impression that you attempted to get verification through more mundane channels about the channeled information. Verify it by, you know, death records or something like that.
Yeah, a little bit, although we didn't focus too much on that. And in fact, one of the things John and I discussed when we were writing the book is are we going to present this in academic double talk of, you know, purportedly came from this person, whatever. And we decided it would be just too confusing for people to read.
It would be awkward speech.
We present it as we're going to assume there's an afterlife. We're going to assume that this material is channeled in good faith, you know, by the medium.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to also assume there's a certain amount of inaccuracy in it. And we're going to treat it like eyewitness accounts, you know, where a cop comes in and says, okay, who came in to rob the store, and he gets 15 different accounts. And then he looks for on ground, you know, what did everybody see the same? And that's sort of the way we approach the material, too, is to treat it like eyewitness accounts where you know there's going to be, you know, bias and inaccuracy and, you know, variety of problems that creep into the material.
I like the way that you presented it, because it was rather like reading, you know, eyewitness accounts, and you could pick and choose what you considered to be the more valid points and just, you know, sort of gloss over the rest.
Yeah, we basically tried to organize the material, too, so that you don't have to read the whole book. You know, if there's, you can look at the table of contents and see what chapter interests you the most. You know, if you're thinking of suicide, please read the chapter on messages to those, you know, who want to take their own lives. You know, if you are someone who has been left behind, a family member of someone who committed suicide, you might want to read the chapter on messages to those left behind. You know, if you just want general information, or if you are into paranormal investigations, you might want to read about the adjustment problems and transitions to the afterlife. So, you know, you organize it in a very easy-to-follow manner where you could just pick the aspect of it that you most want to know and read that perhaps separate from the others.
And it works pretty well, but right now it is time for us to take a break. So, folks, Institute. Please stay tuned, and we will be right back with our guest, Pamela Heath. In the meantime, if you also want information about past and upcoming guests, you can find that at www.gscott.com. And stay tuned. We'll be right back.
The Donna Shades will return with host Gia Scott after this brief break.
Hi, this is James Arthur Yanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio, inviting you to join me on a road to truth, via the path of non-contradiction. Join us each week on Feet to the Fire, a show with the goals of examining a subject matter on its own merits and test how it stands up to the many possibilities found in reality. All without pre-drawn conclusions found in personal bias. No left or right wings here. No pounding the pulpit of ego-driven my way or the highway attitudes. But there are no free passes given either. Answers to questions are important, but equally important is the reasons and methods used to find the answer. Like a contradiction to the final judge here. Feet to the fire. Sunday evenings. Can you listen?
Back to the and our topic is suicides and the afterlife. If you have a question or comment about tonight's topic, please call our toll-free number at 1-877-786-0562. If you're looking for information about this and other programs, as well as archived past programs, you can find that at www.paranormalradionetwork.com. Now, Pam, before we go on with our discussion, Could you tell people about your book and where they can get it back?
Okay, the name of the book is Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife. And you should be able to find it at local bookstores or Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, you know, any of the internet bookstores also.
Okay. And speaking of what really happens in the afterlife, why don't we talk about that?
Well, one thing that's sort of interesting for me is that they go through the same basic stages as everybody goes through. In other words, they have the transition, and then they have an adjustment phase, they have a life review and self-judgment, you know, and so on and so forth. But each of these stages can be a little bit more difficult for them, or in some cases for those who die by sudden death, not necessarily suicide, but sudden death itself can be a problem. The transition phase, they seem to have a lot of problems with confusion, trouble believing they're dead. They may keep trying to kill themselves over and over, even though their body's already dead. It doesn't get through their head. And especially problematic if they were a skeptic in life and they didn't believe there was an afterlife and they feel like they're still alive and they have consciousness and they were so convinced that, you know, once they were dead there'd be nothingness that they just assumed they must still be alive. And then they keep trying to kill themselves.
I read that one account where this spiritual entity just kept slashing its wrists.
Yes.
It really weren't wrists anymore, but kept repeating the suicide over and over and over, trying to end what it thought it could end.
Yeah, and they can have trouble recognizing spirit helpers. We're told there's always someone there to greet them, but they may not be able to see them because you have this real self-fulfilling prophecy. Even in the physical plane, we have a tendency to create our own reality, whether it be with rose-colored glasses or seeing everybody is against you. The difference is in the afterlife, you don't even have a physical body. So you don't have real eyes that can see. You don't have, you know, a body that can touch things or other people who can, you know, shake you out of this. And so your beliefs can literally create your reality and block out, you know, other things. So if you're convinced, just like in that character in The Sixth Sense, if you're convinced that you're alive, you may not be able to see the dead trying to help you, like spirit guides. And you just sort of may be stuck in a fog, especially people who were depressed when they died or on drugs or alcohol. And they can continue to suffer quite a lot because of this isolation and the fact they can't communicate with the living. And they aren't communicating with the dead because they don't realize they're dead or that spirit helpers are trying to help them. And there were a few people who also felt that you can get stuck in this transition phase until your normal lifespan plays out. Now, not everybody agreed with that. So I'm not sure how much of that is a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you believe that you're supposed to live to 60 and you committed suicide at 30, that you're going to spend 30 years in the transition, you know, waiting for that magic moment to cross.
You would think that, you know, time is such, has been debated so much anyhow. You know, you would think that time would be perceived entirely differently by a spiritual entity than a physical entity.
Well, it certainly moves at a different pace, you know, than it does in the physical plane. But again, I was sort of suspicious as I read some of these accounts, because not everybody agreed on that.
Mm-hmm.
That there might have been a certain amount of personal bias, personal belief, seeping into that. But after you get through this transition phase, you do have an adjustment phase, and this is where I think you can see some interesting problems come up, because psychological baggage is the one thing you absolutely take with you, you know?
Uh-huh.
So all your issues, you know, all your personal garbage, it's still with you. It does appear that spirits have a choice whether or not to go to their funerals, and it is common to go to the funerals. I actually was at a funeral a couple months ago of someone who had committed suicide.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know him personally, but I showed up on the ship for other reasons, or the place for other reasons. And it was interesting. He was there. He was there with several guides, and they were standing over in a corner, and there were some other very intuitive people who were there, who also saw him, you know, and the guide. So that was sort of interesting. after we get through that adjustment, let me mention one other adjustment problem. Something I see with people who were addicted to drugs or alcohol is that in the after, I mentioned that you have your psychological baggage, you can also carry with you the psychological part of your addiction. So even you don't, though you don't have a body to continue that physical addiction, you have the psychological addiction. And some of these people will try to hang out with the living and encourage them to get drunk or to get high so that they can vicariously enjoy that feeling.
You know, I read this part and I was like, whoa, because, excuse me, a phenomenon that I've discussed with others on many occasions is sometimes referred to as psychic vampirism.
Mm-hmm.
And in involuntary cases is also often associated with addicts. Mm-hmm. Addictions in some cultures are often called soul sicknesses. Do you think these phenomena could be related?
Yeah, I do.
That's kind of eerie to think that, how would you get one of these, I guess, spiritual addicts to detach themselves from, because when you're trying to help, getting an addict clean of their addiction is one of the most difficult things there is.
Well, they have to admit they have a problem, and they have to want to change. Like, they won't do that till they reach rock bottom.
Right.
But I think the real problem is you've got to get them wanting to change before you can even worry about the entity issue. Because if they're going to keep drinking or keep using drugs, you can keep cleaning their aura and detaching these entities till the cows come home, and they're going to keep, you know, getting
trapped in the garbage.
So, you know, I got to say, as a psychic, I really don't tend to waste my energy on that unless somebody wants to make a change. Now, if they're willing to walk away from the drugs, then sure, you know, it's easy enough for.
I have to admit, you know, I wouldn't call myself a psychic, although, you know, things happen sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most difficult things for me is to spend time with an addict. I just find it, I'm just exhausted. I feel like my soul has been sucked dry.
Yeah, you gotta put up some shields. I know, I actually live in California, and when I first moved out here, I remember I walked down Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, which was a big drug area,
uh-huh.
You know, and I just could not, you know, so many people talk about how much they love Berkeley. I hated it, because it was like every few feet, there was another spirit that was a deceased addict that was looking for somebody to hang with to get high over, you know, and I was like, yuck, you know.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be a less than thrilling experience.
Yeah, well, anyway, But, you know, the adjustment phase, you know, you can talk to these people. And by the way, sometimes they don't realize they're harming the living. For example, you'll get somebody who's really depressed, and they see you, and they think, oh, maybe this person can help me because they're sort of aware of me, and they're hanging around you, and that negative energy, you know, the feelings of depression start to sort of seep into your own feelings, you know, and you start feeling depressed, too. And I've had this happen a few times where I suddenly start to feel, you know, depressed or whatever, and I check around me, and sure enough, there's a spirit there that needs to move on to the light, and I'm just picking up their feelings. And they're not trying to hurt me. You know, they're not even aware they're affecting me, and yet I'm picking up on it. So there's a variety of ways in which they can inadvertently, you know, cause problems to the living.
Uh-huh. And it may not just be suicide victims.
It can be all kinds of people. And
mm-hmm.
Like I say, the main thing is that if you see it as psychological baggage, then you can treat it like psychological baggage. And a lot of times you can be helpful just to explain to them what's going on. That doesn't tend to work with hardcore addicts, but with a number of the other problems, sometimes just explaining it to them so they know what's going on is all they need to understand. Again, that character in The Sixth Sense, once he understood he was dead, he was immediately able to go to the light.
Uh-huh. So, you know, I guess one of the most important things is for the suicide victim who has successfully done the suicide, they have to realize that they are, in fact, now dead.
That they succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that moves us, after we get to the adjustment, we move into sort of the life review and self-judgment, you know, where you look back on your own life. And this is where people actually make changes. This is where they do a lot of learning, a lot of growing. They look back on what their choices were, what there could have been, and how it affected everybody around them. And it's really interesting how this re-experiencing of their choices can lead to an acceptance of responsibility. They literally walk in the shoes of others, experiencing firsthand how their own words and deeds affected other people. And there's probably a couple things that can be particularly problematic for suicides in this aspect. One is that they can be very aware of the feelings of those left behind. And suicide is devastating to those left behind. There's tremendous anger. There's tremendous guilt. This person whose funeral I went to, I didn't even know the guy. And I felt guilty, you know, because I was like, gee, maybe if I'd gotten the information in this book out there better, that suicide really isn't a good choice. And that's the one message you hear over and over from suicides, is that it's really not a good option to take. It won't
That was most definite in the book, that it was...
It won't get you what you want, you know. With the possible...
Whatever you were running away from went with you.
And I will say, with the possible exclusion of end-of-life suicide, you know, when you're terminally ill,
right,
and severe pain, okay, those people didn't have the regrets. But everybody else, you know, it was like, oh dear, this didn't get me what I wanted. If anything, it made things worse. And
and
deal with that.
And was that true so much with the accidental suicides, the ones who really didn't intend to kill themselves, were just acting out for attention or whatever reason?
It got them just as much. A lot of them, their regrets were who found their body or how it devastated the whole family. You know, they just wanted attention. They didn't want to, you know, cause their whole family to be destroyed, you know, emotionally. And they feel those feelings from other people around them. They can even feel the feelings of people who just read a newspaper article about their death and other people react. They can feel all the feelings of the living relative to what they did. And they feel it even stronger than those of us who are living feel it. So it's a tremendous burden for them to take on and to deal with and to work through. And they also have to look at how they failed to master the task they had set for themselves in their life blueprint before they were born. They have to look at how this life compared to earlier ones. The one good thing in all this life review is that you have spirit guides to help you through it. And a lot of times they're trying to point out the positive, the good things you did, you know, the times you helped people, the little successes, the little times you made good choices. So they try and bring perspective and balance to the whole experience. But it's interesting that life review, it's not something that you do just once. It's not one of these things that just flashes through that, bam, you're done. People will go through this over and over and over for months or years, or in some cases, and the suicide bombers or people who, for example, some of the people who were in like Hitler's regime, they're saying this can take 1,000 years.
Yeah. You know, and actually your book really reaffirmed a belief that, I had always had, is that suicide was the ultimate selfish act and that it was reneging on life debts.
Yeah, it is.
Your book really went along with that theme that, you know, what I had believed, you know, always previously is in fact true. I mean, it's not that you're so much going to hell, but the issue is that you have reneged on those life debts, that you have done something immensely selfish because you inflicted grief and sorrow and guilt and anger and all those other emotions on people who really hadn't done anything wrong.
Yeah, and you are forgiven. You are forgiven, but you have to forgive yourself. And that's very hard to do.
isn't what that examination of their life is really all about, is that it's the process to get them to giving themselves to move on?
It's a lot of things. It's learning. It's growing. I mean, I really see it as a very beneficial stage. It's interesting. We had at least one spirit that was followed for several months and kept communicating back. And uh-huh. you got to watch him change. And you got to watch how his attitude and his comments and the way he looked at life and his life changed over the months. And that's kind of something that I think can help some of the living to be able to forgive those who may have hurt them, to understand. If they come back in the afterlife and they've done their life review and self-judgment, this is not necessarily the same person who hurt you. This person has changed. This person looks at life differently now.
Yeah, so that, you know, they have, in fact, grown and learned
right.
and become better than what they were.
And not just suicides. Everybody goes through this.
You know, it's probably a good thing because I haven't met any perfect people.
They might be a little boring, to be honest. But anyway, fortunately, once they get to the self-judgment, there's another interesting stage, which is spiritual work. And this is something which they choose themselves. Again, just like self-judgment, nobody's sitting over them telling them how they have to feel. I mean, they're just making sure that nothing gets skipped or misinterpreted. But you basically do, you know, judge yourself. And then you go back and you say, okay, how am I going to make this right? I screwed up. How can I do things better? How can I make things up? And it was interesting that a lot of the spirits that were channeling messages back to the living, which John and I were then able to, you know, gather up together, were uh-huh. doing so as a form of spiritual work that they had chosen. I was uh-huh. like, oh, okay, this is part of how I'm going to make things right. I'm going to try and see that other people don't make the mistakes I made. And I'm going to communicate my experiences back to the living and hope that it makes a difference. They also, a lot of them, choose to work as spirit guides to other suicides. And again, it's because they've walked in those shoes. They know where these people's heads are at, or these spirits' heads are at, and uh-huh. so they know how to communicate with them. You know, almost like AA in some ways.
Yeah, you know, it is. It's sounding very similar because who better to help you grow through an experience than someone who's already experienced it themselves and come out on the other side?
Mm-hmm. And, of course, some of them will also come back as spirit guides for the living. But, and in fact, with some of the suicide bombers, or people who were affected by suicide bombers, in some cases the victims, not just the bombers themselves, that they were trying to get messages back to the living and act as spirit guides for the living to try and help them make better choices. And then there's also a period where those who believed in reincarnation spoke about trying to get ready to reincarnate and creating life blueprints for future lives that would let them sort of succeed at the task they'd failed at in the previous life. So that's sort of the whole spectrum, and as I said, every spirit seems to go through these, but those who die by sudden death and suicide seem to have more problem with a number of these phases.
Perhaps it would be the shock. I mean, you know,
yeah.
if you didn't expect to succeed and you suddenly did,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, if you died, you know, a sudden death, car accident, or a hugely traumatic injury or whatever, it would be, I think it'd be hard to realize, oh, I'm dead now.
Yeah, and they didn't have time to prepare. They didn't have time to say their goodbyes. So there'd be
uh-huh.
more regrets from that. Although, in general, I don't think those who died by accident had as much problem with their life review and self-judgment.
Yeah, I do know that, you know, in the past I've had injuries and, you know, you come to on the ground and you're kind of going, okay, I hurt too bad to be dead. you know, well, it kind of implies that, you know, you might not realize that you had died.
Yeah.
If you weren't expecting it, you know. I wasn't expecting the injury whenever, you know, whatever hit my head or whatever. it was a surprise, and I wasn't expecting that, and, you know, you come to on the ground. What if when you came to, you weren't alive anymore? That would be...
Yeah, we create our own reality. We really do, and we do it, we don't just do it when we're dead, we do it when we're alive. You know, a lot of how people respond to us depends on the signals we're putting out to them. You know, that's not 100%. The nice thing about physical life is that there's sort of checks and balances. You know, someone can, like I say, take you by the shoulders and shake you and tell you to snap out of it, you know. You can't get that in the spirit realm. What you imagine, you know, what you believe to be true, you can, to a large extent, make to be true. And in fact, one of the more amusing aspects of that is that spirit guides realize that's going on, and they will try and find all kinds of creative ways to be seen by you. So, you know, in the cases of fundamentalist Christians, apparently they will sometimes show up, like, you know, Gabriel and angels with, you know, wings and all this stuff, and and do this whole...
I read that section, yeah. People who had been, you know, actors or performers in life,
yeah,
essentially became spiritual performers to get...
They're going to make your self-fulfilling prophecy, if they can, just to get your attention, and then they'll ease you into reality. And they do the same with the suicide bombers. You know, they may meet them as holy men or virgins or whatever it takes to get these spirits to move on.
Uh-huh.
And I have some sympathy with it. I mean, I can kind of understand why you need to do that. If they're going to be oblivious to you unless you meet their expectation, well, okay, you know, we'll initially meet it, and then we'll worry about gradually easing them into the truth of the situation.
Well, you know, that's a very important thing. Anyone who has ever tried to sway anyone's opinion or deliver information to them, you have to deliver it in a way they're going to see it. It doesn't matter if you just wrote the most beautiful poem in the world. If nobody ever reads it, you know, it was a wasted message. And
yeah.
So you do.
And interestingly enough, that's where some of the bias apparently comes into channeled material. If they look at the medium and they say, this person is never going to accept the truth, I'm going to have to give them a portion of the truth.
Sugarcoat it.
Just give just enough that they can, you know, not blow their mind, not be more than they can handle. And so that's where some of the distortion and inaccuracy can come in with channel material, is if they look at this person and say, this person is never going to be able to handle. And in point of fact, one of the messages that came through to us was that none of us have it right. You know, none of us really know what it is in the afterlife. We all have it.
I have to admit that channeled messages is the only reports we've ever gotten back. It's not like anybody's come back with measurements and samples and, you know, we can't set a probe over there, you know, and so forth and so on. So it does remain this huge sort of mystery that lots of people can make stories up about. And we won't know the difference between it and the truth.
Yeah, and there may be a variety of truths. You know, I think for me, the most interesting part of the book was actually the last third of the book, which was on the suicide bomber material. And we actually had a lot of trouble getting that material because the Muslim world does not believe in channeling. They don't believe that human spirits can come back and communicate with the living. And so you aren't going to find Muslim mediums, you know, putting out books about this stuff. And in fact, we ended up having to use a combination of techniques to try and get at the material, one of which was to approach different mediums and say, would you channel suicide bombers for us? And most of them said no. And so we said, how about their spirit guides? And they're like, spirit guides, okay. So we had a number of spirit guides that come through in this section, and some of them have some sort of mind-blowing concepts. We didn't get all of them into the book because after a certain point, you know, the teacher was screaming at us to keep the book shorter. They wanted to cut 100 pages out, and we didn't do it. We couldn't find a way to do it.
Uh-huh.
But we certainly couldn't add a lot of extra material, too. But it was a very interesting concept, and as I read through some of those messages from the spirit guides, I almost feel like I'm reading and stories. I mean, it just feels very rich, and that every time I read it, I get more out of it. So
Okay, hold that thought and hang on to it tight because I'm notorious for losing that thought. But it's time for the top of the hour break. So folks, do please stay tuned. And if you want to go to www.gscott.com, you can find information about guests both past and upcoming. And myself and Pamela Heath will be right back.
Will return with host Gia Scott after this brief break.
Hi, this is James Arthur Janczyk, the Black Knight of Talk Radio, inviting you to join me on a road to truth on the path of non-contradiction. Join us each week on Feet to the Fire, a show with the goals of examining a subject matter on its own merits and test how it stands up to the many possibilities found in reality. All predetermined conclusions found in personal bias. No left or right wings there. Pounding the pulpit of ego-driven my way or highway attitudes. But there are no free passes in here. And but even the methods used to find the answer. Like a kind
to ICAR, that's International Community for Alien Research, www.icar1.com. I should know, I'm Irish.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Perspective. We all have one. Our entire view of the world is based on it. Welcome to the Unabridged Universe. We invite you to set your perspective aside for a moment and join us on a refreshing journey into aspects of your universe that you may not have noticed from your particular point of view. Let Host Wilson be your guide into the corners of the universe you've never peeked into before. Who knows? You may just enjoy it and end up coming back for more. Take a stroll into the Unabridged Universe, live Saturdays from 7 to 9 Central Standard Time, only on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Get your dose of truth with the Truth Hurts Radio Show with your host Charles Giuliani, Monday, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern. The Truth Hurts. Ignorance.
Do you like to ask questions about everything? Would you like to escape from your proverbial box? Just leap out and explore our world in ways you've never imagined? You can opportunity. As we grow and expand, new features will be added, allowing you to experience radio programming at a fresh new level. I invite you to join me, November Hansen, host of Voice of the People. Together, we can expand our horizons and peer into multifaceted possibilities. This program will broadcast live Saturday evenings on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Tia Scott, and I'm talking with one of the co-authors of the book, Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife, Pamela Heath. If you have a question or comment about tonight's topic, please call our toll-free number, 1-877-786-0562. If you're looking for information about this and other programs, as well as the archive programs on the Paranormal Radio Network, that information can be found at www.paranormalradionetwork.com. Now, before we get wandering off too far, there was something I wanted to talk about with you. I have a personal knowledge of a case where the first person on the scene of a suicide, within seconds of it occurring, was a teenager. Mm-hmm. For a long time after this, she was plagued with nightmares and felt that she was also being urged towards committing suicide, as though she had had a spiritual attachment that fed on that sort of event. After it did go away, but have you heard of that sort of thing affecting others who were in her position?
I think it's certainly something that can happen to anyone who's somewhat psychically sensitive. And of course, we all become more sensitive at night when we're on the cusp of sleep or even while dreaming. In fact, that can be used also for good because you can use that time to communicate with loved ones who have passed on. But in the case of spirit attachments, it makes you a little more vulnerable to them.
Yeah, you know, hearing the story, it was like, you know, the person that committed suicide be encouraging that sort of thing or that other entities would. And, you know, it was terrifying for a teenager.
Yeah, but that's part of the adjustment problem issue. Is some of them, in addition to, you know, wanting you to take drugs or drink alcohol, some of them do want you to take your own lives. Misery loves company, and they feel like, then they won't be alone.
Uh-huh.
So okay. that is one of the adjustment problems you can see sometimes.
Okay, so someone that, you know, was close by could conceivably be, I guess, tempted or whatever.
You can be influenced, I think, is a term I would use.
And maybe that's part of the whole contagious syndrome thing that you see going on. Anyhow, why, you know, communities in ancient times were so afraid of a suicide and would often refuse to bury the body or have anything to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
To do with so many things to drive away that particular spirit.
Mm-hmm.
But I did find that it was a kind of an incomprehensible thing. And it kind of make a little bit more sense.
Well, you might remember when I talked about how, you know, sometimes, like that one time when I was, that happened a couple times, when I all of a sudden I'll feel really down, really depressed. I'm like, what's going on? This doesn't feel like it comes within me. And I'll scan, because I am a psychic. And it's like, darned if there isn't a spirit there, you know, and it needs to be moved on, and it's all depressed, and I'm feeling it's depression. And, you know, for those who aren't outright psychic, who can't, you know, tune into the spirit realm and read what's going on, all they're going to know is they feel down. And
or
it may not even
be
malicious.
Mature and young and lacks life experience wouldn't realize what it was.
Uh-huh.
Or what its origin was.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's natural things coming on, going on, too. You know, you've seen someone die. Death has become real to you. You haven't had a lot of experience with that when you're a teenager. You're going to have a certain number of normal issues, you know, without any entities being involved that you're going to have to look at and deal with.
Definitely. You know, so you've not only got, you know, the mundane, you might have spiritual things going on. You may have psychic things going on. All sorts of things could be occurring.
And one of the things we were talking about in the break, which was the issue of how you commit suicide, may not be random. It can be related to what level of spiritual disconnect you're feeling. I actually found the passage in the book.
You did, huh?
I did. Well, one of the people who
I'm impressed,
who channeled for us, Lauren Thibodeau, is a psychic medium who is also a licensed psychologist.
Uh-huh.
And I remember when she channeled that session and that material, and she and I, you know, since we both have psychology backgrounds, we were like, wow, this is really interesting. We hadn't realized this, that how you choose to die is not random. And depending on what chakra level you have a spiritual disconnect, see, different types of death. For example, third chakra people may commit hara-kiri and eviscerate themselves. Fourth chakra people may shoot themselves in the heart. Fifth chakra can sometimes be neck stuff, such as hanging by the neck, although that can also sometimes be a sexual chakra issue, getting high. Sixth chakra issues, she said, was asphyxiation. So the different levels of spiritual disconnect, where your issues are, may end up getting reflected in how you try to commit suicide. That you're going to actually, it's like you're trying to kill that chakra level where you have your problem.
And just so that people who don't understand know what we're talking about, could you explain spiritual disconnect for us?
Oh, well, that's not something I've had to explain before. I would say that when we talk about suicide in general, it's because you feel othered, you feel disenfranchised. That can happen in a very physical way, you know, feeling shunned by others. It can also happen on a spiritual way, feeling like emotionally you can't deal with this level of issue, or you can't deal with a certain type of spiritual energy that comes through. And most people feel, and I certainly would agree with this, that there are seven chakra levels, and the first one is your root chakra. Those people, by the way, will jump off bridges a lot of times. Second chakra issues, those people will sometimes commit semi-accidental suicide through autoeroticism, hanging themselves while trying to get a sexual high. Okay. Third chakra, power chakra, fourth chakra, heart, fifth chakra, throat, you know.
Yeah, that's really interesting to see that there's a reason why it wasn't just convenient why someone would choose a particular method.
Yeah, and it was particularly fascinating because neither the medium who brought this material through nor myself had ever thought of that. And we were both blown away by this idea. So it wasn't something that came from certainly within our conscious minds. We were both like, wow, we never would have thought of that.
Yeah, because you could have someone with, you know, all sorts of pills that would have definitely done the job, and they'll choose to hang themselves or shoot themselves or stick their head in the gas oven or whatever.
Now, if you're a psychologist or if you're a friend trying to help this person, that's, and they have a failed suicide attempt, that's helpful information. That tells you what problem you need to attack.
That's true.
You know, I think that's what got her and I both so excited. We were like, whoa, this tells you where you need to put your work, because not all of these people succeed. And if they fail, then you can use how they tried to commit suicide as a useful piece of information to help you help them.
Yeah, because it does say in your book, you know, only 1 in 9 is successful. At least 8 people out there that could be helped.
Yeah. Or if you simply talk to somebody who hasn't even tried to commit suicide, but they're feeling suicidal, ask them what they want to do. Ask them what their plan is. That's going to tell you what their issues are. I mean, the issues that are most fundamental. I mean, they may have a lot of other stuff in their life, but it gives you a starting point to address.
Right. It certainly does. That is, you know, I guess when I read that, I didn't think of it in terms of preserving, living, and preventing suicide so much as, wow, that's interesting. I never would have thought.
Well, this whole book for me is trying to prevent suicide. Although, ironically enough, I have used it to help those who succeeded at committing suicide. And I have started taking this book with me. Sometimes if I am asked to help deal with a soul that's stuck and it committed suicide, I'll bring the book with me and because they can see what's in the physical plane, and they can't see what's in the spirit. And then mentally, I'll create a spirit version of the book, and I'll hand it to them, and I'll say, read this. This will explain what's going on. And they have found it very useful. But I actually did it to help the living more than those who have already passed. And
well, I can see that, because actually the dead don't buy very many books.
Well, you know, but John and I didn't do this to make money. I mean, I don't know if I would make a penny off this. We paid thousands of dollars in copyright permissions because we quoted so many books. And not everybody gave us those rights free. We didn't do this for the money. We really didn't do this for the money. And certainly considering the amount of time and effort it took to gather the material and organize it and write it, this is, I think, what...
It was a labor of love, I would suspect.
Absolutely. Well, it was a labor of service. Service to mankind. And I really, you know, John,
it's
I
it's your spiritual
really
work for your karma bank balance, you might say.
Yeah, and John and I both hope that it makes a difference, because there's some really important messages in this book for everybody, not just those who are suicidal. You know, granted, if you're suicidal, the overwhelming message is don't commit suicide. A traditional suicide is not an option. It only makes things worse. But for the rest of us, it has two really big messages. One being that we create our own reality on all levels of existence. And this is especially true in the afterlife. So if we are aware of that, we can start practicing during our physical plane existence, not creating inaccurate reality as they are. And the other big message is that no one is an island. Our actions affect others, and we are responsible for their impact. So we all need to make thoughtful choices in our life.
Now, Pam, I do have a question in text from the virtual auditorium.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, are we predestined to know whether we will commit suicide? Or is that a choice?
No, we have a choice. We definitely have a choice. And there was only one spirit out of every spirit
you know, whose material I read, who claimed that he had had suicide in his life blueprint. And he claimed it was because he had died in every other manner. He'd had lots and lots, you know, thousands of lives and thousands of deaths. And this was the only way he hadn't died, so he was doing it for the experience. Now, I wasn't sure that I believed him, okay? But you're talking one out of quite a few, you know, at least, you know, hundreds if not thousands of suicides.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's extremely unlikely that it would be part of your life blueprint.
Maybe that particular entity was still refusing to accept responsibility
for
his story.
Yeah, he was early on. He hadn't had a lot of time. So I had my doubts about him, to be honest. But that said, you know, none of the others saw it in their life blueprint. All of them said, we screwed up. It wasn't there. Now, I'm going to talk about, that's just traditional suicide. There was also, I think, at least one person who was part of an assisted suicide situation, who was terminal end of, and that was part of their blueprint.
Uh-huh.
Was that they were gonna because they're in part raising this issue in society. It's something that we have to look at and consider and make choices about. But I believe there's always choices. You don't even if it was in your blueprint, you don't have to follow that. You have a choice. And as someone who is psychic, I actually, when I sort of scan futures, I almost see them like a spider web that extend out from me. And probable futures are like thicker strands, and futures that are less probable are thinner. And you can actually feel those shifting and changing as you make different choices. So I'm a big believer in free will. And the other thing is that spirits tell us there's always help. There's always those in spirit ready to help us if we just act and listen. You know, let our minds get really quiet and listen
uh-huh.
to what they're trying to tell us. And that they're always there to guide us. They're just waiting for us to ask for help. And if we ask for help, they will provide it.
Now, I have a second part to the original question from the in-text from the virtual auditorium. And it was, do we know our life blueprint before entering our birth mothers? And do you agree or disagree with that?
I think we do. I also think we tend to forget it. What also appears to be interesting is a lot of children can remember past lives up to about age 5. And as their identities get more solid in this lifetime, that's when they let go of the others. But for those who don't believe in reincarnation, I think the book that's the most impressive from an evidential viewpoint is Ian Stevenson's book, 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation, where he went into third world countries where there was no television, there were no movies, and he found these little kids, sometimes 3 years old, who could speak entire other languages grammatically that they had never been exposed to, could tell you entire life histories of who they had been, who they had known, pick out and correctly identify photographs of people they'd known in earlier lives, people they'd had no contact with, languages they'd had no contact with. They could speak them fluently. That's mind-blowing stuff.
Yeah, that is definitely mind-blowing stuff. And I think I would be a little, you know,
even as a fairly liberal
person, if I had a small child start speaking to me in a language that they hadn't been exposed to, I would be...
And you might think they were making that language up, too.
You know, initially, yeah, you might.
If you didn't know a lot of languages.
Right. And, you know, I've heard a number of languages, but, you know, sometimes small children's babbling can resemble a language that you don't have a great deal of familiarity with.
Well, actually, I've had a number of mothers come up to me and tell me that their child gave them reincarnation stories when they were about age 3, and then they forget them. But it's interesting. It's not uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
It's not at all uncommon. But that gets us off the subject a little bit. Sorry.
Yeah, it sends us off on another tangent. We got about 5 minutes before we go to the last break of the hour,
okay. So
I don't want to do anything too terribly complicated, or we're gonna not have enough time to finish it. Let's see. I did have a question here that I hadn't asked you. the reasons for committing suicide, and that these reasons actually affect, you might say, that evaluation period initially after their death. You know, some reasons were justifiable, like, you know, you're in a coma, there's no chance of recovery.
Yeah, that seemed to be a well-accepted reason from the spirit realm. They didn't have any problem with that. I think the other thing that really surprised me as a doctor, because I'm not, I am not real pro-euthanasia. I've been asked to do that, and I am not comfortable with that and will not do it. But they do not consider someone who assists, and someone who is end of life, they don't consider that to be murder if you assist them. And that surprised me. That was,
well, you know, as you know, someone who, you know, I've been, you know, the elders in my family, we lost a number of them over the last decade, and the people get the life support questions, you know, and you thought about it for the first time maybe in your entire life. Okay, if someone is on life support and there is no chance for recovery, could I or should I pull the plug? And that's a real deep, personal, moral question, because is it murder, or is it simply giving the body and soul the choice whether they're going to continue to live or not?
And certainly the latter appears to be the spirit realm's viewpoint, that it's not murder, that in fact, if anything, it's a mistake to hold these souls back, to tie them to a useless husk of a body. That seemed to be the message that was coming through, although there wasn't as much material on that as there was traditional suicide. And I'll say the other thing that's sort of interesting is if you commit suicide because of mental illness, there's a lot less stigma attached to that, too. You know, and then
I did find the perception of mental illness in the spiritual realm to be interesting. There didn't seem to be much stigma to it. Mm-hmm. It was just regarded rather as they're broken, let's fix them.
Yeah, chemical imbalance in the body. And then you drop the body, the chemical imbalance is gone, bam, all of a sudden you're normal and you're not necessarily as culpable. You know, intention, you mentioned it earlier, intention is everything to the spirit realm. What are you intending? Are you intending good? Are you intending, you know, to hurt others? That makes a difference, and in fact, that's part of why the suicide bombers are in a much worse position than traditional suicides in some ways, because they intend to hurt others.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, you know, it seems that someone who committed suicide to protect others didn't seem to have the same sort of stigma.
Correct. Correct.
That is kind of, to realize that the intent is understood just as clearly as the act itself.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of, you know, kind of...
And their message is...
And comforting, too.
Yeah, but that's true for every choice we make.
And
it gets back to that whole thing of no man being an island, that we're all interconnected, and our intentions towards others, and every choice, even if it's as simple as how we're greeting them, that's something we're going to look back on and think about later. And so it's something that we would be prudent to think about at the time we're doing it.
Yeah, I have to admit, you know, that intent thread that does weave through your book, you know, if all of us took that to heart, we might have a nicer world to live in.
That's the truth.
Yeah, yeah. And we are now nearing our break. So, everyone, please stay tuned. This is the last break of the show. And we will be right back with our guest, Pamela Heath, and we're discussing suicide and what happens in the afterlife. And we're discussing suicide and what happens in the afterlife.
Donna Shades will return with host Gia Scott after this brief break.
Hi, this is James Arthur Blanchick, the Black Knight of Talk Radio, inviting you to join me on a road to truth, in the path of non-contradiction. Join us each week on Feet to the Fire, a show with the goals of examining a subject matter on its own merits, and test how it stands up to the many possibilities found in reality, all to the predetermined conclusions found in personal bias. No left or right wings matter. Counting the people of ego-driven my way or highway attitudes. But there are no free passes in it either. Answers to questions are important, but equally important is the reasons and methods used to find the answer. Like a contradiction in the future.
UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades with our guest, Pamela Heath. And we're discussing tonight suicide and what happens in the afterlife. While we were on break, we were talking about a personal experience on my part, which really didn't have so much to do with suicide as it did with grieving and how you can bind the soul to this plane. And my personal experience was actually pretty simple. My son died when he was 10 years old, and just, you know, a few months after he died, I'd had this dream where I was at a barbecue, and all my relatives were there, including those who already died and everything, and I was fixing a plate of food for my son, who had also died at that point, and he was decomposing, and, you know, it was a really graphic, kind of gruesome dream. And in the dream, my grandmother, who is also deceased, told me, "You have got to quit doing this. You have got to let him go or he'll keep rotting." And for me, that was kind of a wake-up call that, you know, really you need to get on with getting on, that this isn't healthy, this isn't good. And, you know, in your book, you did mention that, especially a parent's grief, can bind a soul to this plane and not let them move on. Essentially turns them into a spiritual yo-yo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are a lot of messages about that, and it's pertinent not only to suicides in terms of the grief and guilt you may feel around what happened, but also in terms of children or other loved ones who have passed on through normal means, mm-hmm. illness. It can also affect, believe it or not, celebrities, from what we're able to hear. But when you are not wanting them to be dead, especially if you create like a shrine to that person and you don't want to accept their death and you keep pulling them back and wishing they were alive, it's almost like a chain that chains them and holds them back from being able to complete their transition. And apparently spirits can be stuck for decades, if not longer. There were certainly some child spirits that spoke of being stuck until their parent died. And then they were finally released and able to finish their transition. And this helped me.
I can think of a few celebrities, too, that would have been definitely stuck. You know, people like Marilyn Monroe, yeah. Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
You know, the list actually goes on because they have these huge fan clubs. You know, the traditional joke about, you know, it's a truck stop sort of thing might not be too far from the truth in a sense.
Yeah, I know Chris Fleming, who was the medium on Dead Famous. And a lot of the stuff he actually got never really made it to the TV show. But he felt that a lot of times he got trickster spirits coming through. He also got some legitimate celebrity spirits coming through. And some of them, their message was, let us go. Let us go. You're holding us back. You're hurting us. And it can happen with any spirit. It can happen with children. It can happen with loved ones, a spouse. It can happen certainly also with suicides. And one of the big messages that came back from suicides to those left behind is the need for them to let go of their grief, you know, and to get on with their lives. They want to reassure us that we're still loved, and that they're still connected to us and they care about us, but that this grieving helps no one.
No, that's very true. Grief, you know, it's an important process of moving on, but it's like anything else. It's supposed to be, you know, it's not a lifelong avocation.
Yeah, and I would have to say that some of the quotes that we had to support this material in this chapter were some of the most moving quotes. I mean, I'm just flipping through the chapter right now, and I'm looking at some of the things, and it's like a Mateau channeled one. It's like as if a child is crying, and you reach out to help them, but you're behind a wall, so they don't see you're there. You're knocking and yelling real loud, but they can't hear you. How do you walk away from that? You know, I mean, some of these quotes, they're just very powerful messages.
Right. We would keep dragging them back to this particular plane with that kind of grief, you know, that creating a shrine to someone isn't healthy for the living or the dead.
No, and there are ways, actually, that you can help the dead to move on, that you can sort of do the opposite of holding them back. I mean, one of the more common messages that also came through was that they actually are affected by our prayers. And I don't care what your spiritual beliefs are, any kind of heartfelt well-wishing, you know, wishing that they do well, wishing that they make smooth transitions, you know, hoping that they are able to move forward, that helps them, you know.
I remember in the book, you know, that it was like a rainbow,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all sorts of things. It was actually a beautiful description.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they actually see the energy as colored lights, you know, like an aurora borealis almost, or rainbows that's being sent their way.
Now, I have a question from the virtual auditorium. For the child who's waiting for them to keep getting pulled back, are they walking around alone, or do they have spirit guides with them? Or
they definitely have. Well, certainly spirit guides try very hard to be with them.
Uh-huh.
I think it may depend a little bit on how how far they've made it in their transition. I mean, some of them will describe it's like they feel the spirit guides pulling on them to try and pull them forward, and the parents pulling them back, and they're stuck in between, and feeling almost like they're being torn apart, and it's not a pleasant feeling for them. And you still have that self-fulfilling prophecy again, in the sense that even with children, if they're focused on those left behind, they're not going to see the spirit helpers so much. But we're told there's always helpers there, and certainly spirit guides try desperately hard to get through to children, and I think, to be honest, the majority of them, they are able to help.
Uh-huh. So, you know, how would, you know, we were talking about how to help a suicide victim or a child. You know, we all do have a natural empathy for children, and the thought of one of them being caught in this nothingness between, you know, planes is kind of horrific in a way.
Yeah. Well, prayer helps is one thing. But a really big piece of it is letting go of our own anger and grief and guilt, you know. And I say those three together because often there are little intermixed portions of those, you know. Why did God let this happen? You know, I'm angry about
uh-huh.
it. I feel guilty. What if I had done things different? You know, even if there was nothing you could have done different, you always ask that question.
Exactly.
And the grief. And so these emotions sort of combine, and they make a knot that hurts us, but it also hurts our loved ones because they are still connected to us. They can feel what we're feeling, and they're helpless to stop it. Only we can stop how we're feeling, you know?
Uh-huh.
I mean, they do come back with these messages saying, yes, your love, please let go of your guilt. Please let go of your anger. Please let go of your grief. Please forgive me. That's another common message. Forgive me. You know?
Right.
And we have to do that. We have to be able to move on. And
so like anger that's continually focused as someone who has committed suicide.
They feel it.
Would that bind them the same way?
It's hurtful to them, but it doesn't bind them the same way as refusing to accept that they are dead.
Uh-huh.
Those are slightly different things.
Uh-huh.
And trying to pull them back and saying, I wish you were here. You know, I can't believe you're dead. You know, I want you to be alive. I want you in my life. That's pulling someone actively back versus, I am so mad at you I could spit nails. You know,
anger towards, especially towards someone, you know, anger is a normal part of your grieving
yes.
process anyhow.
Yes.
But especially towards someone who has committed suicide.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you do feel like it's a waste that they've reneged on life, you know, what right did they have to bow out and cause me this sorrow? I mean, real anger towards
yeah.
the suicide victim.
Yeah. And in fact, even from people who don't know them, like they said that, you know, even if someone just reads a newspaper account of their suicide and is angry about it, they'll feel that too. And they have to deal with that on top of dealing with their own emotions about what happened and their own feelings about their life during their life review. And it's just an added burden. And it doesn't help anyone. It doesn't really help us left behind either. It doesn't help us accept things or move on or learn any lessons
uh-huh.
either. So none of us benefit. It just ends up being a waste all around.
Yeah. But, you know, when I think about it, the anger towards someone who's committed suicide, in a sense, may be harder to let go of because you have, in a way, you have less incentive. It's sort of a revenge thing. You know, if I stay angry at them,
yeah,
now I'm really hurting them.
By golly, they deserve it. But the thing is, my personal belief as a physician is that that anger affects your body. And it's interesting how often you see health issues, which are literalizations of how somebody feels about a situation.
Well, you know, I have a friend who is a psychic, and she has often told me that skin problems, rashes and whatnot, is caused by built up anger inside, you know, that you're not expressing, and anger towards life or whatever.
On your own skin. I mean, a lot of things, you know, you look at people with back problems, you can sometimes just look at their language, and they'll say, oh, this is, you know, a back, you know, this is going to break my back, or they'll say, oh, this is a pain in the neck. Well, where do they develop problems? Their neck. The unconscious mind has a way of literalizing stuff. And whether it be, there have been some studies that show, formal studies, that show that breast cancer patients have a higher incidence of nurturing issues. And so it's not random. And when we accept these emotions and these feelings and we dwell on them, it's affecting us. It's not just affecting those, you know, who we might be angry about. It's also going to affect us to some extent. And I'm not saying you want to deny your emotions. I think you should feel your emotions. You should accept them, but then you let them go.
Yeah, well, it's like anything. If you bottle it up, refuse to move past it, it's going to have repercussions.
That's right.
You know,
and very destructive repercussions on you.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So prayer would help a suicide.
Even just well wishing. It doesn't have to be formal prayer. It can just be thinking thoughts. Oh, I hope you move on. I hope, you know, I hope that your transition is a smooth one. You know, wishing them, letting go of your own, you know, just recognizing, no, you're not guilty. They made this choice. They took this action. You know, there's nothing to say you could have stopped it. You know, you are not responsible for their choices. They are responsible for their choices. You can only be responsible for your own choices. And so letting go of some of your guilt over that, letting go of your anger that they hurt you, that they really hurt you, and recognize, yeah, they're probably really sorry they hurt you. And I can tell you, the vast majority of suicides, the second they've done it and realize they succeeded, they regretted it. And they regretted how it hurt those they'd left behind. A lot of times they were actually oblivious. At the moment that they committed suicide, they were in so much pain. They were oblivious to what the impact was going to be of the choice they were making. And it was an inevitable choice.
Whether it's true or not, I've often been told that if you can prevent someone from committing suicide for 10 minutes, that often they will choose not to.
I don't know how true that is. There's certainly people who will try over and over again, but my belief is that if people understand what they're getting into, if they understand choices and what the repercussions of those choices are, which is what this book is about, it's saying, look, if you want to do this, this is what's probably going to happen. Know what you're getting into. At least if you still commit suicide, you'll better be able to navigate and understand what you're dealing with. And maybe you'll actually make a wise choice not to go that route.
And it's important, too, for those who are left behind by the suicides to realize that, no, because you asked for a divorce, you did not make them commit suicide, or because you didn't give them that raise, you didn't make them commit suicide, et cetera, et cetera.
They had other choices. You know, there's always other choices. I mean, that's the message that came through pretty often. There's almost always other choices for traditional suicide. You know, I'm going to keep repeating that because assisted suicide appears to be quite a different situation in many ways than other forms of suicide.
Well, going back to the suicide bombers, you know, and we talked earlier that someone who was mentally ill was, you know, given a sort of a pass for being, you know, excused. They were ill. They were incapable of thinking this through. Is it, you know, I would almost think that you would have to be mentally ill to be a suicide bomber.
No, not at all. What was interesting is that they have a lot more in common with traditional suicides than anything else. They're feeling spiritually disenfranchised. A lot of them feel they don't have another choice, that this is the only out. This is their only way of dealing with things. There's certainly a chapter book talking about the history of this. It's been used for thousands of years. We even have records of it being used by Jews, you know, 2,000 years ago for freedom from Rome.
Yeah, I remember reading that part. You know,
so this is not a new
thing. Suicide versus slavery, you know?
Yeah. But it's still not a good choice. And it was very interesting reading what got channeled from suicide bombers or those who claim to be suicide bombers, because a lot of them didn't want to admit they were wrong. And the guides would say, you have to understand, these people are very early
in their transitions. You know, they have not done their life reviews yet. They don't, you know, they don't have a full perspective. And the only thing they'd admit to was that the afterlife wasn't what they'd expected.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, no joke. It's not what you expected. But there were some interesting cases where suicide bombers would agree to come back and reincarnate as, say, the victim's brother and help the victim raise their children. I mean, they would try to find ways in future lives to recompense, you know, the harm they had caused.
Okay.
And I will admit, the victim had to agree to this. This was not something that they could do without the victim's consent. The victim had to be able to forgive this person and accept, okay, this is what they're going to do to try and pay me back.
Now, and sort of a similar note, people who have committed suicide in past lives, are they apt to repeat it in
Yes, very much so. Yeah, according to the reincarnation statistics, there is an increased incidence of people committing suicide or being tempted to commit suicide in this life if they've done it in previous lives. And so it can be a tendency, and some of the spirits talked about that. It can be a bit of a tendency that they're not proud of and they're kind of embarrassed about. And it's something that they work to try to overcome. And I was mentioned when I was writing this book, one of the impetuses for me to write the material was that I had a friend whose son was suicidal. And he was 15, and I was trying to get across the information that this would probably not be a good choice on his part, and did succeed with that. But one of the comments he made to his mom was that this was actually the oldest he'd ever made it, that his last lifetime he died at 9. He committed suicide at age 9.
You know, I, as a parent, I find that terrifying. I mean, why would a 9-year-old want to commit suicide? What could be that horrible about your childhood?
Well, sometimes it's accidental, and sometimes there is abuse. But we actually had a number of children, or spirits that claimed to be, you know, children when they died of suicide, put it that way, who had died playing the choking game, where they hang themselves in order to get a sexual high, an orgasm.
And not realizing dead is dead forever?
Well, I think children have trouble understanding the permanency of death, but also some of them, they knew it was dangerous, they knew they could die, they were doing it anyway, so it was very definitely risk behavior.
Maybe not so much as they intended to kill themselves then, it was a byproduct of their other behavior?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, that was sort of one of the interesting things in the book, is that, yeah, that a lot of these so-called accidental suicides are not really accidental. I mean, on some level, on an unconscious level, this is what they wanted. They wanted to die. That's why they were engaging in risky behavior to begin with. They might not have been
suicidal
consciously.
A lot of times when it seems that a child dies of an accident, it may have been one they arranged.
Yeah.
They did whatever, knowing that it would probably result in death.
There do seem to be some cases of that, you know, but I think when you're talking about something as sensitive a subject as that, you have to take things on an individual level and look at each situation on its own. But it's certainly, the choking game is something that's becoming more and more common in this country, and that was part of why it was kind of nice to include some material on it. There were three different kids who came through, and they had different perspectives, and they had different comments. But I think the one thing that really came through is none of them had thought about what the effect would be on their family to find their body, their dead body. And and one case, I think it was a little brother who had found him, and he was traumatized for life. And he's like, wow, I just realized this would happen. I wouldn't have done it. And their message to other kids who might be playing this game was, think about your mom. Think about your kid brother. You know, would you really want them to find you?
And, unfortunately, we're at the end of our time. So we're going to have to stop right here, even though we could probably talk for another 2 hours about this. But I thank you very much for being the guest tonight, and it's certainly been an interesting show, and think about things that I had never thought about before.
Can I just give our websites real quick?
Sure.
My website is www.PamelaHeath.com, and my co-author's website is www.jonklimo.com. And we both have more information about the books. We have the original preface for the book, which was cut for space reasons. That would let you read a little bit of the book. I hope people check it out and that the information is useful.
I hope so, too. Once again, tonight's guest has been Pamela Heath, the co-author of Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife. Next week's guest will be Ellen Dugan, and a whole different topic again. So, have a fantastic week. Remember, life is a learning game worth living, and remember to smile and love. Until next week, I'm your host, Gia Scott, and have an enlightened week. And remember to smile and love. Until next week,
I had enough.
Well, you drove out there into the middle of nowhere and had some sort of loud verbal display challenging E.T. in general out in the middle of nowhere?
Oh, yeah, that's what I was doing. I actually had a pistol in my hand at the time. I was really kicked off. When I was having this fit, I was waving the gun in the air, okay, and I had this fit. And at this moment, I said, okay.